Hello and welcome to episode 394 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous. You can share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. This will air on Monday, March 20th. We don't have any free classes coming up, but you can always look further ahead into the future. I guess the next ones are in April. You can go to lsatdemon.com/classes.
Right around the corner.
Yeah, let's just jump in. We have an email here from someone hoping for some guidance.
It says, honestly, I'm in a rough spot right now. I'm a Canadian student who just graduated with their undergraduate degree in December of 2022, and I've been thinking about law school for a while now. Unfortunately, and I don't want this to sound like an excuse, during the tail end of 2021 and throughout 2022, I was faced with situations I have never faced before emotionally, and it took a toll on my mental health, and I messed up my LSAT journey. I took the test for the first time in 2022 with decent studying but not enough, and got a terrible score. I canceled it, thinking I could obviously do much better because I've been capable of such things in the past, and I know I didn't study enough. I took the test again later in the year but got a score of 125. It's still shocking to me. It's much lower than the score I originally got, and I started panicking because I can't apply with that. After taking my studying seriously, I took a third time and scored 143. I know, it's terrible in hindsight. But honestly, I wanted this more than anything else, and I at least wanted to try and apply and maybe pray for a miracle. But I've been rejected from a few places so far, and I feel like I know how this is going to go. Yikes. So far, yikes. Although, this is really common, right? People do everything wrong frequently, so you're not the only person to, make a mess of it. It's never too late, I don't think, to right the ship. Anyway, someone hoping for some guidance continues. I've taken the test three times with a canceled attempt, a 125 and a 143 on my LSAC report. Yep, we got that. I'm at a point in my life right now where I have to choose what I want to do. And I just want to know if it's even possible for me to get into law school in Canada anymore. Even if I worked hard and scored well on my next LSAT, would it even matter? Will I be accepted? My GPA is well above 3.0 and I have a lot of work experience / volunteering and softs and whatnot. Lots of references. Furthermore, I want to add that I don't think it's a matter of if I can do it, because I feel like I can definitely make the improvements and get the score I need. But I need to know if it's worth the effort. Otherwise, I'm going to transition into another field altogether. Thank you for your time. Someone hoping for some guidance. Ben, you want to give someone some guidance?
Yeah, so some schools in Canada do average your LSAT scores, and that's going to make it very difficult for you to get a score that would work for those schools.
But I think we can go ahead and say the ship has sailed on those. Yeah. The schools that average, I think you're fucked. But my understanding is that even in Canada, it's only a couple schools that average. So you need to find out which ones average. And I think, you can go ahead and plan on not applying to those schools.
Yeah. And so you go to the schools that take your highest score and you can totally go to school. It just depends on whether you can improve your LSAT score. So what you need to do is not make the mistakes you made before. You need to focus 100% on improving your LSAT practice test scores. How do you do that? You don't take a bunch of practice tests. You drill, you take individual time sections, and you review all your mistakes, and you learn them, and you make sense of them. And then once your practice test scores, which you might see once every 2 weeks or once a month, start getting into the 160s or higher, hopefully, then sign up and take it officially. You have two more attempts, right? The canceled attempt still counts against you, right?
Yeah.
So you have two more attempts. So make sure your practice test scores are mid 160s and then take it. And then take it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it sounds like you're making the critical mistake, which is you're signing up and taking official LSATs when you have no business doing that. I mean, your practice tests are not going to lie. And, you keep saying I was studying seriously, but you don't study seriously and drop scores like 125 and Well, the next time you said you studied seriously and got a 143, boy, that's still pretty pathetic, like compared to what, you know, Ben and I often say that like 160 is kind of the bottom of our comfort zone, where if it's any, and I think I would prefer 165, but with 165, I know like, okay, if you really want this, you know, you can do this. But with a 155, if that's the best you can achieve, that's a number that'll get you into school, but it'll also get you into trouble because, you know, with a 155, you're frequently going to end up overpaying for law school and just like potentially not doing very well there because you don't have the goods one way or the other. Like you either don't have the English, you don't have the logic, you don't have the work ethic. There's something that you're missing there, and that's going to be bad when you get to law school.
Yeah.
So I would be say, you know, I'd say, okay, you claim you can do this. You know, you're very confident. You don't think it's a matter of whether you can do it. Okay, well, then do it on your practice tests. And you need your practice tests to be solidly in the 160s before you ever register for another official LSAT. You've only got two more chances. You've already squandered three of your five chances that you get in 5 years. And you got to stop doing that. So, you know, just don't even register for an LSAT until your practice tests are in the 160s. That's how I would rehabilitate this particular applicant.
I agree.
Well, then let's move on. Yeah, thanks for writing in. Christopher has a subject here that says easing the pressure and staying patient.
Hey guys, I've been studying since late August, got a cold 146, and just took my first LSAT in February. I was not super happy with where I was, hovering around 160, but I work a full-time job and felt that I needed a test date to get myself motivated to study.
Yeah, that's just like really... why?
Yeah, you're focusing too much on the outcome,
yeah,
as opposed to on the process and learning. I mean, this is a test of the English language, of logic, of your ability to work. Those are all inherently good things to focus on improving outside of a test score or a test date.
And motivation is like, you know, that's part of that how hard you can work component. I don't know, like I really encourage you to develop self-motivation, and it shouldn't be driven by external factors like official test dates. I think you should take your practice tests more seriously. You know, you can put a full practice test on your calendar for April 2nd or whatever it is, and then you can gear up for that practice test like, you know, like, okay, I'm taking that test seriously, and I'm going to study for that test. Why does it have to be an official test on record? It's just so dumb. People squander their official attempts when they could just use practice tests instead.
Yeah. I mean, I think motivation is inherently tied to what you're aiming at, but I would just prefer that people aim at something much closer to now, which would be your understanding of this next question, or accuracy, right? We talk about accuracy all the time. When you take a time section, can you get 5 out of 5, the first 5 out of 5? Can you get the first 10 out of 10 correct? Like that's the thing I want you to aim at, because you can also get the benefits of your efforts today or tomorrow, right? Like I think when someone needs an official practice test to aim at, they're focusing on the top of the mountain as opposed to the next step.
Yeah.
And doing the steps right and getting better and better at hiking or whatever.
Well, I had to schedule my summit attempt of Everest, even though my training, you know, I wasn't happy with my training, but I had to do it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, well, we didn't even make it to base camp. Shocker, because you weren't actually ready for your summit attempt.
Yeah. So Christopher continues, I got a 159, which I can't be super disappointed about. I was practice testing between 158 and 161.
You can't be disappointed at all with that. That's
right in your range. Yeah.
It's in your range. Like, what are you talking about? I can't be super disappointed. Is this magical thinking? Like, you thought you were going to score way higher than your range? You're not. You're going to score something in a reasonable range of your practice tests. So, like, that's, you should be happy with that. You should be thrilled with that. That's a number that's right in line with your practice tests.
It shows that your practice tests don't lie, right? It shows right. that your practice tests are telling you this is where you're at, and you really are at that point. Right.
And it was foolish of you to take that official test. I hate to beat people up for past mistakes because, you know, we really are forward looking. Like, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
But where we go from here is we stop doing shit like that. You know, you're just like squandering, well, $210 and a Saturday and one of your three attempts in one cycle or five attempts in five cycles. And you're just like burning up money and burning up attempts because why? You needed to do that in order to motivate, huh?
Yeah.
Unfortunate. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you're talking about the $200, but the bigger money that you're burning up potentially is by not getting your best score on record, you could be burning up tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships. That's a real challenge. So anyways, he continues, I want to aim for the high 160s plus, okay, a spot where I believe the University of Minnesota will give me money. Christopher, I don't love the fact that you're hyper-focused on only one school. Yeah. I think you need to see yourself as someone who can go to many schools and that many schools will want you. It's just a better mindset going into this process. Anyways, I'm just going to say one more thing about this. If you are hyper-focused on one school, you have just given that school all the power. You've just handed over a ton of power in terms of what you're willing to accept to go there.
And it's like maybe give you a baseball, you know, it's like you're, well, I want to learn how to hit 260 so I can, so the Minnesota Twins will sign me. Okay, why don't you learn to hit as good as you can possibly hit and then put yourself out there in the market for the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Mets and the teams that like break the bank to get the very best players in the world. I mean, why are you, you're like setting your sights low by so specifically targeting this one school. You should be targeting the competitor schools of Minnesota, right? Like, if you really want to get the money out of University of Minnesota, you should make yourself a candidate who's going to get into Michigan or get a scholarship offer from, I don't know, some other school that competes with Minnesota so that you can make it so that you're just like an undeniable no-brainer at Minnesota. Instead of 100%. Being like, oh, I want to barely reach the minimum, you know, this number that's going to just get me the scholarship. Why not just set your sights higher? I think people don't realize how good a cold 146 is. We know that for sure, right? Somebody who starts at 146, like you should expect to get to the mid 160s.
Yeah.
And it won't be surprising at all if you get to the 170s. So, yeah, I mean, I think your goal should always be the highest LSAT you can possibly get, not here's the number Minnesota requires. But okay.
Yeah, lots of aiming here, right?
Yeah.
Christopher has, and we're taking issue with what your goals are. But to take your analogy just a little bit further, you also don't know which teams are looking for players with your skill set.
Yep.
That's why you have to apply to a bunch of them, because some of them might be, oh, shit, we're losing this guy. We need a replacement. And that's true for law schools too. It's very hard to predict who they're going to try to fill their class with once you hit the numbers.
Yep.
The struggle I have been having is how I get all of my scores to increase together. Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
There is still a level of inconsistency where I can have a 22 out of 25 on a logical reasoning, but a 16 out of 27 on a reading comp, and vice versa.
That's because you're not that good at logical reasoning, and you're also not that good at reading comprehension.
Yeah, when you have that big of a swing, you're
like,
just
sometimes you do really well. Guess what? Sometimes I hit driver really good. Sometimes I putt really good. My problem is I got to get my driving and my putting to be good on the same day. Bullshit. You're just not that good. Sometimes my driver is shit, and sometimes my putter is shit. That's because I'm not that good at golf. Like, if I wanted to, I don't need to work on my consistency. I need to fucking practice sometimes, and I don't. Yeah. So that's why I'm always going to be really inconsistent. I don't put in the work. You've got to put in the work, and you put in the work toward your practice tests. And it's not about inconsistency. It's about the ones that you miss. Like, if you're getting 16 out of 27 on a reading comprehension section ever, it means that you're not reading carefully enough. You're not understanding what's in the passage. You're not understanding the question that they're asking you, and or you're not understanding the answer choices. So you need to read it more carefully. If you can ever even occasionally get a 16 out of 27, then that means you're not that good at reading comprehension, and you just need to get better at the underlying fundamentals. Don't look at an occasional, you know, but sometimes, Nathan, I get 26 out of 27. Well, okay, that's good that you sometimes get 26 out of 27, but sometimes you get 16 out of 27, and that's because you're just not that good at it. So sometimes you get a little lucky, like I get a little lucky on the golf course sometimes. And yeah, you can have this illusion that you feel like your skills are better than they actually are if you only look at your good days. But when you look at your bad days, it's not a matter of inconsistency. It's a matter of, yeah, you're just not that good. So get good.
He continues, I feel like I've improved significantly and have a much better understanding of the test than before, but that has not shown in my practice test scores.
That's okay. It will eventually.
Yeah. I'm trying to stay patient, but it's been a struggle. I recently upgraded to live, and I've loved the experience thus far. How can I break out of this seemingly endless plateau? Okay, so I think we say this on every podcast episode, but I'm going to say it again. Stop worrying about scores overall, plateaus, or big numbers. Worry about the questions that you get wrong. That's where the solution to all your problems lies.
Yeah. You're a live subscriber, Chris. That's amazing. If you're a live subscriber, then I want you to come to my class, and in my class, I want you to get every question right. Like, let's see you do it. If you come to my classes, there's going to be a syllabus full of real LSAT questions, and your job is to solve those questions. If you miss a question, well, that's the test telling you, here's what you don't understand about the LSAT, and that's where you need to honestly grapple with it to figure out why the hell you're making those mistakes. In class, I'm right there. So I'll explain it to you. If you still struggle, tell me and I'll explain it to you again. And I'll explain it to you a third way and a fourth way and a fifth way. I'm actually really patient when it comes to helping people genuinely understand a question that they're missing. I know I seem impatient when people are talking about numbers, 22 out of 25 and 16 out of 27 and a cold 146 and my goal of one whatever. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. Let's look at your performance on one question. So that's how I would encourage Chris to use our live classes. You know, same thing, go to Ben's class, genuinely try your hardest on every single question and just expect that you're going to get them right. Because you're not. And when you get them wrong, that's where it's like, well, Ben Olson is there in the room to help you understand, because that's your problem. Your problem isn't inconsistency. Your problem is that question that you just missed.
That's it. That's the key, Christopher. One question at a time and learn it. And you'll eventually wake up and be at a much higher LSAT score.
Thanks for writing in. Sorry for yelling at you. But I mean, like, I want to like shake you out of the... You think there's a plateau, and it's not. It's not a plateau. It's you're thinking too much about the big picture statistics instead of thinking about the thing that underlies those statistics, which is one question at a time, and you're just making lots of mistakes. Well, if you want to break out of the plateau, you got to stop making those individual mistakes.
Yeah, this next email here is from Jason. The subject is COVID year UGPA. Am I screwed? Question mark.
I've been studying with the demon for 2 months now and have seen a great increase in my practice test scores from a 144 diagnostic to a 158 on my most recent test, practice test. Okay, great. 14-point improvement in 2 months of the demon. Nice, Jason. This has only motivated me more to shoot higher than my original goal and look at applying to higher ranked schools. Love that. Get greedy is a core philosophy at the demon. You know, like we almost always people set their goals too low. And we're like, what? You're shooting for a 156 so that you can get into podunk law school? Like, whatever. Why wouldn't you set your sights higher? So that's great that Jason is adjusting. For some context, I graduated in December of 2021 with a 3.43, and my junior year was derailed by COVID. And the way my institution handled its transition to online learning.
I don't love that, Jason.
Yeah, don't say that out loud. Why don't you love that?
Well, I'm very curious. Did everyone in your class suffer the same drop in GPA as you did?
I can hear Ben talking to his boys. Really? That's why you didn't do, you know, that's why you didn't, you know, whatever, make your bed, huh? Oh, did that stop all the other boys from not making their beds?
I'm sorry, Jason. Things happen in life and they make whatever we're trying to accomplish more challenging. And I'm sure that COVID and the way your institution handled its transition to online learning made maintaining your GPA more challenging. But some people figured out how to navigate that challenge and some people didn't. And so
it's okay.
Just more. Yeah.
It's okay that you didn't navigate that challenge, but you have to eat it. You just have to shut up. You have to own it. You can't ever say that. You can't say it was derailed by COVID. I mean, yeah, no shit. Like the entire world was derailed by COVID. So, you know, you're not like talking to anybody who didn't have similar challenges in their lives. Mm-hmm. And then you especially have to just swallow the way my institution handled its transition to online learning. You cannot ever say that to anybody. Just shut up. Just
imagine that in a personal statement.
That's right.
Like, oh, okay.
Or an addendum. I bet people put that shit in addendum all the time.
Yeah.
And that's probably what Jason's going to ask.
Oh.
Maybe I'll continue. Is it me? Yeah, it's me.
It is you. I do want to say one more thing, and that is, Jason, even if a lot of this stuff is someone else's fault, focusing on what you could have done differently to navigate it more effectively is really the path to doing better in the future, right? As long as you keep pointing your finger at someone else, even if that's valid, what can you take away from that?
Yep.
Anyway.
I have always been an A/B student, and on my transcript, I have a full semester of C's that directly correlate with the pandemic. My senior year, I completed 36 credit hours with all A's, 4.0. I'm hoping schools will see this and realize that this is an irregularity in my performance as a student. I called my undergrad to see if I could have those COVID year C's changed to pass-fail so they could be irrelevant in my transcript, thus increasing my GPA to a 3.73. They unequivocally said no, and I feel a bit discouraged. Any advice on how to move forward? I'm real glad that Jason tried to get those things changed to pass fail. I might actually encourage Jason to try again. Like, is there a higher court? Can you appeal?
That's what I was thinking. Or also becoming more familiar with the process. Sometimes when you go to your adversary, so to speak, and say, hey, can you help me with this thing? They may not give you advice that's in your best interest, right? I'm not saying the school is necessarily your adversary, but you're asking them to do something and it's probably just easier for them to say no.
Oh, for sure. And who did you call? Who did you even talk to, right? I mean, this could have been like a student employee in the office and they're just like, I'm busy smoking weed over here. Like, what are you talking about? You know, like,
you want to change your grades? No. Sorry, you can't do that.
We can't do that. I don't know how to do it. Or I don't know how to do that. And so they just say, no, we can't. That's not something we do. I don't know. I mean, you might ask questions like, is there a process for changing grades after somebody graduates?
Yeah.
Like, is this ever possible in any circumstances? Can you tell me about those circumstances?
Yeah. When has this ever happened? And you might need to do research slightly outside of the, before the call. So you're more prepared, right? Yeah. Someone who comes in and says like, no, I know that we can do this. I just need to figure out how. And that can change the conversation entirely.
Show them evidence of this happening either at your exact school would be best. But even if you could show them evidence of it happening at some other school, you might, I don't know. There's potential, like, what would a lawyer do? Mm-hmm. Would a lawyer make one phone call and then just say, okay, yeah. Or would a lawyer, you know, make a dozen phone calls and send seven emails and just, you know, refuse to accept no for an answer? That's what a lawyer would do.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that I would do here, which is not related to your grades, is I would just shoot for the best possible score you can get. I mean, that's what you should do anyway, and it sounds like you're already trying to do that. But yeah that's something you do have control over.
Sure. Yeah, best LSAT you can possibly get. So keep grinding away in the demon. Set your sights high. You know, something in the 170s if you can. And just keep kicking ass for as long as it takes to get your LSAT. You know, you could eventually end up being a splitter where your LSAT is well above the median of all the schools that you're looking at. And that 3.43 is probably going to be below the median, at least at top schools. But the LSAT can make up for a lot. I think you also do have a case here to write an addendum for sure. Not that the addendum is going to really do anything, and please do not mention that your institution mishandled its transition to online learning. Like that would keep you out of law school potentially, because you look like a pain in the ass when you're blaming an educational institution while trying to get admitted to an educational institution. I definitely don't do that, but you could, state the facts that you've stated here.
Just two sentences, right? Like,
I like the recalculated GPA. I mean, I think you could point to a couple things. I think you could point to that 4.0 of 36 credit hours in your senior year. That's, you know, like, put that in the addendum, and also put in there, if my COVID year grades were removed, my GPA would be a 3.73.
You could do that. I mean, I kind of like the idea of just ending with that 4.0, have that one number stick out.
Yeah, or both, maybe. I mean, give them two different numbers to anchor on. I don't know. I can see a couple different ways you could do this. The truth is, it doesn't really matter, right? It's gonna. Yeah. You might feel a little bit better, and there's some chance that they might see that and go, "Oh, you know, yeah." I mean, look at this guy. He's at least got an increasing grade trend, and they might be willing to look at your recalculation and go, "Yeah, you know, take COVID out of it. It's actually a 3.73," and they might start to think of you as a bit of a diamond in the rough, but. The big LSAT is the thing that's going to really sell that story. Without the big LSAT, they don't give a shit. With the big LSAT, then they're going to, you know, maybe pay attention to that addendum. But don't talk shit and don't make excuses. Just give them the facts.
Yep.
Thanks, William writes in with a subject, LSAT timing. Is it too soon to take the test?
Good morning. I'm just beginning to consider law school. I graduated undergrad with a 3.71. and only plan on going to law school if it's free or very cheap. I will be 41 when I begin that journey because I need to complete 4.5 years in my current position to earn a pension.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. So a little far out here. My question is, when is too soon to take the LSAT? I heard on a YouTube question and answer with a former student of yours that she was getting notifications to apply to schools with fees waived after LSAC published her score. If I took it this year or next and happened to do well enough, would those offers still be good if I plan to start school in 2028?
Whoa.
I think that schools will gladly accept your application and waive your fee in the future if they did recently. My only concern would be that your score gets taken off your record, which will happen after 5 years. So it sounds like you'll be fine, but Just keep that in mind.
Yeah, after 5 years. It's 2023, so 2024, 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, you are right on the edge of it. I might look into exactly when that, because LSAC has its weird shit with the cycles and everything, right? So it might be 5 cycles, or could be 5 calendar years, or who knows. It strikes me, William, as maybe a little bit too early to be taking it officially if you know you're not going to law school until 2028. That said, if now is a good time for you to prep for the LSAT, yeah, I think you could prep now. And
if you take it in August or September or October, you're
after the new cycle. Yeah.
You're
the new cycle
it.
Starts in August. So maybe don't take it between now and August. But I don't know. Now we're speculating. I think, William, you need to go on the LSAC website and look up, like, how long do scores stay on your official record. And don't just give it lip service or like surface treatment, because surface treatment is scores are good for 5 years. But what does that exactly mean, according to them? Like, when does the 5 years, what's the deadline? I don't know. So you're going to have to call LSAC or chat with them on their website, LSAC.org, and you're going to have to get that question answered by the official powers that be.
Yeah. And maybe twice.
Yeah, because they do sometimes have poorly trained reps. We've heard them multiple times giving bad advice. So, yeah, maybe try them today and then try them again in a couple days.
See if you get somebody different. Yeah, you got 4.5 years.
So. Yeah, right. Yeah. There's no rush here, William. I mean, like, are you doing this because you want to get fee waivers? That's weird, because if you're not applying anytime soon, then that'd be a dumb plan. Is there some chance that you might be going to law school sooner? Then it makes it more reasonable that you would be taking the LSAT now.
Yeah.
Hope that's helpful.
Yeah. This next one is from first name, Frugal and Anonymous. Okay. Subject is prestige or money, ? You.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. Writing to you as a couple who are applying to law school together. Oh, God.
What?
What?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's funny.
That sounds terrible to me. It sounds like you want to break up.
Yeah, law school is not a great place for couples, by the way.
Okay, law school is a terrible place for couples. People frequently break up and or get actually divorced when one of them goes to law school. The two of you going to law school together, it sounds like a recipe for divorce. But anyway, retaking the LSAT isn't an option for us. Oh, dear God.
Wait, why?
Neither is R&R for family reasons. Do you know what the hell they mean here by R&R?
Rest and relaxation?
That's what I thought you meant, but like, that context doesn't make any sense.
Makes sense. No. Rinse and repeat?
Rock and roll?
Okay.
I don't understand.
Maybe it's retaking and retaking.
Retaking and retaking?
Because there's two people here, right?
I don't understand your abbreviation, but I'm going to go ahead and push back on retaking the LSAT isn't an option for us. I'm going to say bullshit, unless you've both exhausted all of your 5 attempts in 5 cycles.
Yeah.
And I don't want to hear family reasons. Okay. Well, then you shouldn't go to law school. Like, stop it. If you're not willing to retake the LSAT because of family reasons, then you're definitely not willing to go to law school because of family. I mean, it's just like law school is wildly intensive compared to the LSAT is.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, we continue. We both have been offered full ride scholarships to a T100 that neither of us are wildly excited about. Parentheses, it's Maine. We would love to go.
T100? Who says that?
Who says that? Schools that are ranked in the, 92nd in the country. They love to talk about being a T100 law school.
You're in the top 100. There's only 200 in the country. Okay, anyways.
Right. We would love to go to school together, yet realize that it is not always an option. This offers us an option. The offers to Maine, the two full rides to Maine, offers us an option and negates the possibility of crippling debt that would further delay life plans. We would appreciate your thoughts on juggling a generally bad school versus graduating with debt from a much higher ranked school. For career plans, we are interested in clerkships / public interest / private practice. Not a huge pull for big law, so not concerned about that aspect. Would love your opinion on what we do with this offer.
Okay, well, first of all, I would say hard line rule here. Don't take on any debt, because the debt burden you both are going to take on is going to be double, because it's both of you. And who knows, one of you may enjoy law school, the other one may hate it. I think just don't even entertain taking on debt. Now the question becomes, should you accept this offer that's a full ride? I think that dramatically reduces the risk. I don't care so much that it's a low-ranked school, but if you don't want to end up in Maine, then you probably shouldn't go there either. So that gets us back to retaking the LSAT.
Yeah, and if that isn't an option for family reasons, then I think you guys should just go back to the drawing board on your law school dreams to begin with. I mean, if you can't, you're in such a damn hurry that you can't retake the LSAT.
But you're going to move to Maine and
go to law school for 3 years,
yeah,
and become a lawyer? Yeah. Something just doesn't smell right about this whole plan. Like, you're talking about further delaying life plans or whatever. Like, so you've got complicated plans for children, maybe, and a house, maybe, and retirement or whatever. You need to think more about like what your actual career is going to look like. And you know, maybe Maine does it for you perfectly. I don't know what you say you want to work in clerkships / public interest / private practice. So you're telling me that you want to be the kind of lawyer who doesn't make a lot of money, right? Like, it's pretty stark that big law is where lawyers make a lot of money. All other lawyers don't.
Yep.
That's a broad brush, but I'm getting like 95% accuracy with that broad brush.
Sure.
So you're going to be a lawyer who doesn't make a lot of money. So debt is just not even an option. I mean, I agree with Ben 1,000%. Like, whatever you do, do not borrow money. And if you guys decide to go to Maine together and you don't incur any debt, you know, I'm going to predict that on average, like maybe one of you is going to end up practicing law. And on average, you guys are going to get a divorce. But putting that aside, I don't know. The Maine plan doesn't sound that bad. I strongly question this, whatever other schools you're thinking about, you know, because you're like, well, but I want you to compare that with graduating with debt from a much higher ranked school.
It's
what
not
school
be
are
any
we
better.
Even talking about? Yeah, yeah. Like, you're looking at a school that's ranked 60th in the country or something. Well, that's no different from 100th in the country. That does not meet the 2X rule, where if one school is not ranked double the other, then they're essentially ranked the same. So anything ranked 98th in the country is just, to us, fully equivalent of a school that's ranked 50th in the country. There's really no difference between those two. And it would be terrible to take debt to go to a more prestigious school if that more prestigious school is ranked 50th. I mean, that just makes no sense whatsoever. And if you're thinking like, come comparing Harvard to Maine, well, then that's silly too, because nobody is going to actually be choosing between Harvard and Maine. There's going to be many, many intermediate schools. If you can get into Harvard, you can probably get into Michigan and Georgetown and like all these other schools that are much more competitor schools of a school like Harvard. So I don't know what we're talking about here. I think you, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm a little confused as well, but I will say this. I'm going to double down on the debt idea because, Nathan, you said it, right? You're going to predict on average that they're going to get divorced. Well, if you don't take on this debt, chances are less likely
true
that you get divorced, right? The number one reason people get divorced is because of money. So, yeah. You know, help yourselves out by not going into debt. And keep in mind, you're still going to have to pay for your life for those 3 years. So it's not like this is going to be free. Anyways.
Two people going to law school. What do you think about that? Young couple, two of them both going to law school simultaneously?
Well, I mean, now that you ask, I almost wonder if one of them is more excited than the other, and the other is just going along with it.
Yeah, does one of you have, like, a good job? Because if one of you has a good job, I think you should keep that good job and let the other one go through the misery of law school and then recalculate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually not a bad idea, because then you could go debt-free for law school and still pay for life, so you're not incurring any other unnecessary costs.
Yeah, one of you pays the bills while the other one goes to law school, then you flip. Because trade, this like romantic idea of going to law school together, I mean, that just, what are you going to hold hands in the lecture hall? I mean, there's no point. I don't think you're going to be study buddies. Dear God. I don't think people realize how miserable law school is. You don't need to share that misery. You can have separate misery.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Good luck.
Good luck. Thanks for writing in. I mean, you're asking for my opinion. My opinion is this whole plan stinks. Like, it doesn't. The only part I like about it is don't pay for law school. If you can go for free and you've got these full ride offers, that's great. You know, maybe you should take one of those offers, but it's a school you're not even excited about. What school are you excited about is what I want to know.
Can you reapply in the fall with a better LSAT score?
Well, yeah. I mean, like the kiss of death, right? I knew this plan sucked when I read retaking the LSAT isn't an option for us. It's like, that's just not acceptable. What do you mean it's not an option? It's always an option. Unless you're literally out of attempts, in which case I apologize. Yeah. But I will accept no other excuse because it's just too important. It's the beginning of your entire legal career. You're going to rush through the beginning of your legal career, like the foundation of your legal career. You're going to rush through that because life plans and family reasons.
You claim to be frugal, and that is the key
to
really knocking out the expenses. And yet it's like you're going to just skip over that, brush over that.
Yeah.
No. That is the step you need to take to mitigate your costs.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Thank you, Frugal and Anonymous. I think, you know, maybe only Frugal goes to law school and Anonymous keeps working.
Yep.
And then they switch and Anonymous goes to law school if they're still together and Frugal works.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Next one is... from Reddit. First name, all one word. From Reddit.
From Subject.
Reddit. Should I write this extra addendum? Go ahead, Ben.
My stats are 2.7, 153. I just submitted my application, but I'm wondering if I should email and attach a separate addendum regarding this matter. What matter? Your low numbers? I know my choices aren't optimal for someone who is primarily location-oriented. So there's literally only one school that I may have a slim chance. The love of my life lives in Los Angeles and long distance has been brutal. Hence why I'm only considering going to law school in LA as I, more than anything, want to marry her.
Wow. Okay. So, two in a row with like relationship LSAT or relationship law school. Yeah.
I was wondering what the question is, but I realize now that the question is in the subject. Should I write this extra addendum? And I guess the question is, should I write about my desire to only go to LA?
No, I think the question is, should I write an addendum about my stats?
No.
Right. Because you're not giving us any. What are you going to say? Like, I have bad grades and a bad LSAT?
You're going to bring more attention to them? Like, oh, by the way, I just wanted to point out that my numbers are low. If you had a 3.5 or a 4.0 in your last semester, you could talk about that. But I think the bigger problem here is you're applying with a 2.7 and a 153.
Yeah, that's your problem. Your problem is the bad LSAT and the bad UGPA. The bad UGPA, you can't do anything about. The bad LSAT, you can do something about. You know, you stop applying to law school with terrible numbers. Like, you already have applied.
Go get a high LSAT score.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No shit.
Yeah, you want to impress her? This is what you're going to do. You're going to get a high LSAT score, and then you're going to apply to multiple schools in that area. How many schools are in Los Angeles or around there?
Well, there's UCLA, there's USC, there's Loyola, there is Southwestern. Those might be the only four ABA schools that are in LA proper, but Pepperdine is in Malibu, Irvine is in Irvine. And then you could start expanding from there. But I mean, there's at least six schools that are arguably in LA. It depends on what part of town she's in and where you want to be. But, you know, this, like, you're doing it all wrong here if you're like, I want to get in. You say there's literally only one school that I may have a slim chance at, which sounds like you're just going to try to barely squeak in. You know, with a 2.7 and a 153, yeah, that's like you're going to barely squeak in to Southwestern. And I have friends who went to Southwestern on a scholarship and ended up with lives that they don't completely hate. So it's possible. But 2.7, 153, I don't know if Southwestern might make you like a partial offer or something. I think you need, just don't go to law school with less than a 160. That's pretty clear to me.
Yeah, I put a 2.7 in the estimator and a 165. In San Diego, you could go to California Western for free, but that's in San Diego. Golden Gate, of course, that's in San Francisco. what else we got here? Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of options even at 165, but maybe a 168. Oh, that opens up some more. Yeah. Get a good LSAT score.
Yeah. And also, I mean, man, if you really want to get married, like, look, you think you have found the love of your life and you want to marry her, I think you should get a fucking job. That's what I think you should do.
Yeah.
I mean,
it doesn't sound like you're going to get much money, if any.
No, and it doesn't sound like you're going to make very much money as a lawyer either, to be honest. You know, sorry for the brutal honesty, but most lawyers don't make $100,000. Lawyers who go to law school with a 2.7 and a 153 and barely squeak in to Southwestern are not going to be the kind of lawyers who are going to make big money.
Well, so, and even if they make $100,000 or $80,000, they're going to be burdened with debt and be servicing that for the first 10, 15 years.
Right. It's a losing proposition. I mean, you're going to lose money on your law school investment, certainly in the short run. I mean, for sure, for 3 years, you're going to be going into debt. And then for what? Because you hope that you're going to have a lucrative career in law, but those aren't the kind of numbers and these aren't the kind of schools that lead to lucrative careers in law. You know, I'm sure Southwestern is telling you that the average starting salary for a lawyer is $100,000, but most people who go to Southwestern don't make anything close to $100,000 starting salary. You know, you're going to have 5% of the class that's going into big law and 95% of the class that's going to make somewhere between $45,000 and $75,000, maybe.
Yeah.
And you could make that much money at Starbucks in Los Angeles, literally. You know, so I think you should get a job. I think you should work and I think you should save money. And if law school is something that's really in the cards for you, I think you should be applying with a 160 something and you should be applying more broadly and not limiting yourself. Like, get married first and then consider
then bring
going
her
back
along for the ride.
Exactly. Yeah. Once you guys are married, then presumably you'd be able to open up your doors. But like deciding that you're going to like narrow down your law school choices because of this person, that's
who you may not be with in 2 years,
especially right? Not after you go to law school, because as we have just mentioned, I mean, I swear to God, it's like a 50% breakup rate
yeah
in law school. somebody should do some studies on this, but it's probably higher than that.
Or you break up with law school and do really shitty in it, and now it's worth nothing to you, but you just spent money on it because you're dedicated in debt to her.
And you broke up with her. She dumped you. Oh, man.
Or I'm saying, like, if he doesn't break up with her, he's given her all this time, and now law school has been a failure, right? Low grades. People break up precisely because they dedicate so much of their time and stress and energy into this endeavor called law school.
Which you better do. You damn well better do it, or else you're not going to be successful in law.
Yeah.
So you got to decide. I mean, do you want the girl or do you want law school? And I think you should stick with the girl. That's fantastic. You found the love of your life. Good. Go get a job and marry the girl and then figure out if you want to sometime later go to law school with her as your partner. That's fantastic. But, excuse me, trying to do both at the same time just seems like a awful plan.
Okay. Thanks for writing in and good luck. This next one is from our very own Kevin.
Really? Nice. Hi, Ben and Nathan. Each week, I put a new inspirational or funny quote related to learning or the LSAT on my whiteboard. The one I found for this week gave me a hearty chuckle. However, I think it's also insightful, especially if one is studying for the LSAT and or wants to pursue a legal career. I hope you find it as entertaining and intriguing as I did. I think this quote also serves as a reminder to take a moment and have some fun while pursuing something serious, like a good score on the LSAT. Here's the quote. I took a speed reading course and read War and Peace in 20 minutes. It involves Russia. And that's from Woody Allen.
Okay, so speed reading doesn't work.
Yeah, the lesson there is that speed reading is bullshit, obviously. I mean, you know, does it pass the sniff test? It doesn't. You can't actually speed read and comprehend. It's just crap. It's been, I think, thoroughly debunked. Ben's been teaching LSAT for 15 years. I've been teaching LSAT for 15 years. I've never known a single student who successfully employed any kind of speed reading in order to do well on the LSAT. It's just not about speed. It's about accuracy. If you understand, then you're going to be able to quickly answer questions. If you don't understand, then I don't give a shit how fast you read it because you didn't actually read it. You just don't understand it. So yeah, skim War and Peace and, oh yeah, Russia. Yeah, right. Exactly. You got what you put into it.
Yep.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Yeah, thank you. This next one is from John. The subject is sub 3 splitter.
Okay.
Sub 3. I don't know if I'm familiar with that.
Sub 3.0.
Oh, got it. Okay, thank you. Do softs weigh more with a really low GPA and a high LSAT score?
It's so funny. Like people just, they grasp. People love to just like go, they want to go back to softs always. And then just like, yeah, they want somebody to blow smoke up their ass and tell them that the softs are going to, you know, and because the law schools are more than willing to do this. Like that's how they make their money is that, you know, they convince people, oh, well, you know, you're not just numbers to us. Okay. Right. You're not numbers to them if your numbers are right. But if your numbers are bad, then you're just, they're going to deny you based on your numbers. Who do they think they're fooling?
Yeah. Okay. So John writes, hi, Ben and Nathan. Thank you for taking the time to read this. I'm 27 and have been working full-time out of undergrad for the past 4 years, working in both politics and higher education at a business school in South Florida.
With business school, I'm going to start calling that Trump case. When you capitalize things that have no business whatsoever being capitalized, that's called Trump case. Why would you ever capitalize business school?
I don't know.
Where did I get that?
I mean, I know Trump did that all the time, but is he on your mind or something? Or where did that come from?
He's the most famous example of like, who else has ever done that besides Trump?
Yeah. Yeah.
Trump loves putting, I mean, he just capitalized great out of nowhere. It's like, huh?
how did that happen? How did that happen?
That we elected the dumbest person? I don't know. Okay. Anyway, John, I'm sorry for associating you with him, but don't randomly capitalize things. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So you've had some work experience. After graduating with a 2.7 GPA due to being homeless, my first year of undergrad. Wow, okay. I have made it my goal to make up for this by studying for the LSAT every day while working.
Nice. I hope you're doing it at work.
Yeah. However, I was wondering, with my years of work experience, do you think they would look more closely at my resume and high LSAT score rather than my GPA from years ago? I know I want to go to a T14 and practice big law, but I feel like my chances are slim with my GPA. Thank you, exclamation point, John.
Your chances are extremely slim of getting into any top 14 with a 2.7 GPA. That said, it's not impossible. You are going to need a really big LSAT, though. Like, John, let's be honest. What do you think big law is? You know, what do you think the top 14 is? What do you think big law is? It is an academic competition to sort the real killers from the not real killers, because if you're, you know, doing this $1 billion litigation or whatever, you got to have the goods, and your 2.7 doesn't demonstrate that you have the goods. So you have to demonstrate the goods with a really big LSAT. It's silly to be looking at your softs. You should instead be thinking about your LSAT.
Yeah, that's your only chance of getting into a T14 is a very high LSAT score, mid 170s or higher. I wonder if John could, like, John, what were your grades after your freshman year? I know you're saying, hey, I have a 2.7 because of my homelessness, my first year of undergrad. But were your grades any better or that much better after that? Because you could write an addendum. You could also reach out to your school, asking them to make those classes pass fail. I don't know. Like, is there anything you can do to get that 2.7 up? Because that is low.
It's kind of rare, but every once in a while you'll get a sympathetic undergrad that will say, oh yeah, sure, no problem, we can turn those into pass fail. Or, oh, you retook a class and we still show the old F on your transcript, but you retook it. Yeah, we could take the old F off your transcript. I mean, who knows? They could easily say no, but they might say yes. So you should definitely ask. But putting all that aside, you need a top 14 LSAT. You know, you need a 170 something. If you don't get a 170 something, your odds are slim of getting into any T14. And other schools, you know, you have a very, very slim chance of practicing big law.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I know you want us to pat you on the back, John, and, you know, tell you that, oh yeah, they're going to look at your softs, but I just don't even really think that's true. They'll tell you it's true, and they would look at your softs if you had the right LSAT where you became undeniable. You know, if you apply with a 2.7 and a 175, then they might take a look at your story.
Well, what do you think about John's goal to go to a T14? I mean, you want to practice big law. You can go to a top 20, top 25 school, go for free so you mitigate the risk.
Well, yeah, of course. Like, definitely whatever you do, John, don't pay for law school. You know, go to the best law school that'll give you a full ride. Apply broadly. If that means you have to apply outside the top 14, then so be it. And yeah, if you end up going to a school that's ranked 25th in the country, you know, they're going to have some big law placement, right? Like, it's going
to
be slim.
And if you're going for free, you're at the top, or you're closer to the top of the class, which increases your likelihood of, you know, getting those jobs. I mean, it's going to be very school specific. Some schools, it would be better to go to a higher ranked school to get that big law job. But as a general rule, if you go for free, then you're going to be in the top of the class, and you don't have the risk associated with servicing a huge debt load.
Well said. I agree.
Okay.
All right. We have an email here from Anonymous. The subject is cycle update / recap. Good morning. Just sharing a bit of a cycle recap. I have a 3.5-ish GPA and a 177 LSAT. I followed y'all's advice and applied early and broadly. I applied to the entire T14 and then a few select schools in the T50. I was waitlisted by much of the T14, but accepted at Georgetown, Northwestern, and UVA! I'm waiting on scholarship information from a few schools, but so far I have a full ride plus stipend to Wash U. That's in St. Louis, Missouri. 80% scholarship to Notre Dame and George Mason, and then 60% scholarship from UVA, which is in the top fifth of their scholarship offers. It's great that you know that, Anonymous, because you are clearly looking at the 509 reports for these schools and, you know, trying to figure out whether the offer they're giving you is actually a good offer. Unless I decide to take another year to work, I plan on attending UVA in the fall! I want to clerk and then work in DC big law counsel on the Hill, so UVA is worth the tuition cost to me. I followed y'all's advice, retaking until I got the score I knew I was confident in, even if I was tempted to shoot for higher, as my 177 was an underperformance of my practice tests. Wow. You know, like John, our previous correspondent, there's your competition, John. Someone who has a wildly better GPA than you do and a 177 and thought about retaking it in order to get higher.
Yeah.
You know, John is like writing in asking us for encouragement, right? I mean, I think ultimately that's what John really wants. Like, well, but that will they look at my softs? John, you're competing with this correspondent. You know, you got to be honest about that with yourself. You're applying with a full GPA point lower almost than Anonymous. And Anonymous has a 177 on record and thought they could have done better.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're like hoping, but what, but my resume.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. But I bet Anonymous has a pretty cool resume as well. And if it's a matter of whose resume are they going to look at first? Well, they're going to look at Anonymous's resume first. And so, I don't know, like, I just think people need to go back to the drawing board kind of on what they're expecting. Law school generally is for people who got really good undergraduate grades, right? Law school is for people who are good at school.
Yeah.
And you've documented that you're not that good at school. You can rehabilitate that potentially by showing them that you're really fucking good at the LSAT. You just got to remember that the top 14 killers are, they look like that. And this killer is getting waitlisted at most of the top 14.
Yeah. Well, you know, I put Anonymous's numbers, 3.5 and a 177 in the estimator. And for UVA, it's estimating actually less than half. So this correspondent is potentially overperforming.
Well, and that's why you apply broadly, right?
Yeah.
So Anonymous did a great job here by applying to the entire top 14, plus some schools outside the top 14, like Wash U, like George Mason, like Notre Dame, you know, fishing for full rides, and got the full ride plus stipend at Wash U, which is fantastic. And Wash U definitely has big law placement, by the way. So it's just, those are the kinds of people that you're competing against. And if you think that, like, softs or some addendum or something are going to make you a serious contender, I just don't think that's the case. I mean, these people are like, 3.5 is already bad enough to get waitlisted.
Yeah. Yep. I
mean, 2.7 is bad enough to get straight denied.
Yeah. Even with the 3.5, I'm looking at all the top 14 and most of them say less than half. Duke says more than half. Georgetown says more than half. WashU says more than half.
That's why you apply to the, like, portfolio, right?
Yeah, exactly. You don't know who's going to be like, yeah, we'll take a chance on this person. Yep.
If you want to invest in stocks, you do not buy one stock. You buy a whole portfolio of stocks, and you expect that some of your purchases are going to turn out to be losers, but some of them are going to be winners, and the winners are going to be big enough winners that it's going to make up, more than make up for the losers. Well, that's what Anonymous did here by applying to, it sounds like, 20 schools.
Yeah.
And yeah, UVA found something in that application. Maybe it was the softs, but UVA found something in that application where they were like, you know what? This is worth making a hefty offer. And they made a better offer than they normally make. And that's the type of place where we might actually endorse paying something for law school, right? Like, the comparison for Anonymous is, I could get paid to live in St. Louis at Wash U, no tuition at all, and get a stipend of some sort, put me in a really good financial position. Or I could pay a hefty amount of money still to go to UVA, but not, you know, but less than most people at my school. If I really do have a scholarship that's in the top fifth of their offers, then that means that, you know, at least 80% of the class is getting a worse deal than I am. And yeah, then it might arguably be worth it if given that you want to work in big law in DC and, you know, like Wash U places people in big law in DC, I'm sure. But UVA is going to be a much easier DC big law placement.
It's also right on the line. UVA is ranked 8th and Wash U is 16. So
we could argue about, yeah, that's right on the edge of the 2X rule. But I think people, you know, there's
more people know UVA.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Are we done?
I think so. Congratulations. I don't know. This is just a update, right?
It's just a cycle update. Yeah, there's no question here. Fantastic. But I do love getting these and I love putting them out there into the world because I don't, law schools certainly don't give anybody the correct impression of how competitive the legal field actually is. Yeah, there's hordes of people who look like Anonymous every single year. And there's even bigger hordes of people who look like John, who are, you know, hoping to get by with a splitter. And I mean, I bet because Anonymous is a splitter, right? That's like what an actual big law splitter looks like, is 3.5, 177. Yeah. John's 2.7 and who knows what else at. It better be a 177, right? Because otherwise you're not even in the conversation with Anonymous. So I think we can do a pretty good service by just putting out there in the world. The law schools are going to gas you up, right? I mean, that's just what they do. If you talk to a law school, you're talking to a salesperson. And those salespeople, their job is to get you to apply so that they can deny you or waitlist you or try to charge you full price. Or if you're a really good applicant, give you a scholarship. But all they give a shit about is getting your application.
Yeah, it's a win all around. The more applications they get, the more choices they have. Yep. It improves their yield. It's all good, good, good. Because even if they don't love your numbers, well, hey, maybe you're one of those candidates who can pay full freight and fund the school.
Yep. If they can, if they deny you, it helps their rankings. If they admit you on a scholarship, that helps their rankings because they're admitting you on a scholarship because of your numbers, and that helps their rankings. So whether they love you or hate you, your application always helps their rankings. So their incentive is purely just to tell you what you want to hear in order to apply.
Also, if they can pull you away from other schools, that helps them yet again.
Right.
And if you're applying to them, you're less likely to apply to more other schools.
Especially the more you talk to them and then they think that they can like get you in their pocket kind of, you know, and oh, well, just why would you bother applying to any other schools?
Yeah.
And that's what they really want is, for you to apply to them and them only so that they can then name the price and you don't have any choices.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to hear, we're just not going to gas you up here at the Thinking LSAT podcast. I mean, you're going to hear the real stories of like, here's what it looks like when like this is what a promising splitter applicant looks like. And John, I'm not telling you that you can't be a promising splitter applicant, but without a killer LSAT,
there's no way you're going to the T14. And even with a killer LSAT, you're probably going to be paying a lot. So just open your eyes to more schools.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I think we can leave it there.
Cool. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 394 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.